Hello, it's Tom here. We'll get into the latest episode of Last Orders in just one moment with the brilliant Andrew Orlovsky. Before we do that, I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has been leaving their ratings and their reviews on their podcast app. It's a really great way to support the show. So if you haven't done that yet, please do take 30 seconds on your app to give us a glowing five-star review telling us how much you love this show. Also, a big thank you to everyone who's been sending in their postbag questions. It's been a really nice addition. We really enjoy answering them. If you want a chance to have your question answered on the next show, do email those questions into lastorders@spiked-online.com, or you can tweet at us or get at us on Facebook. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the fall of FTX, the uselessness of electric cars, and what Devi Shridhar did next. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Tom. Very well, thanks. You?
Very well, thank you. Very well. We're delighted to be joined on the show today by Andrew Orlovsky. Andrew is a columnist over at Telegraph Business, and also, I'm pleased to say, a regular contributor to Spiked on all matters technology, green issues, and all kinds of other insanities in the kind of modern marketplace. Yeah, Andrew, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Lobby stuff, you can say. Yes, thanks for having me.
So we're going to kick off today, Andrew, by talking about a couple of your kind of areas of expertise or your beats. First of all, with FTX and the kind of great crypto collapse, but also electric vehicles. But let's start with FTX, because this is a story which is huge. I mean, the collapse of this very fated crypto exchange last year, the head of it, Sam Bankman-Fried, had become a kind of celebrity in many respects, had become a kind of very celebrated figure, the new Warren Buffett, as he'd been dubbed and so on. Also seen as a very philanthropic, the kind of kindly or student-y face of modern capitalism, that it couldn't be all bad. It could be both innovative and generous. And yet it's not turned out particularly well for him. I mean, the company has collapsed under allegations of fraud and much else besides. He's facing some pretty hefty federal charges. And a lot of people are kind of looking around wondering what the hell happened. So even though there's a lot to talk about here, in a nutshell, as much as it's possible to say, what was FTX and what happened there?
Right. Well, we're looking at the world of software as money, of sort of the unregulated wild west of cryptocurrency. I mean, I gather that some research shows that 1 in 10 British people has dabbled in this. It's a speculative world, full of obviously frauds and pyramid schemes and scams. But the fascination has kind of continued that if money becomes software, it has some kind of unique properties which the regulated institutions, which of course are using software, but the money itself hasn't got these properties attached to it, has some promise. And I think that's kind of kept the whole show on the road. FTX was interesting because there are only kind of two or three gateways between the Wild West, between the world of funny money and a world of real money. So if you've made gains in the cryptocurrency world, you need to kind of convert them back so you can buy a house or a Porsche. And really, there are only Coinbase and Binance. And Binance was a great rival of FTX. Now, FTX is a fascinating story in many other ways as well, because this was the most unlikely group of people to ever run anything involved in finance. I think they had almost no experience of running an exchange, of market making. The chief regulatory officer was a guy with a couple of shady poker, online poker companies behind him 10 years ago. Nothing here looked like it added up. And the only person to raise questions about this was this legendary short seller called Mark Cohodes, who said, this is really, really strange. But FTX had kind of bought its way into respectability by wooing the Democratic establishment. It was the second largest donor to Democratic causes. But also it wooed the sort of very online world by claiming he was an effective altruist. So he was cover material for sort of left liberal intelligentsia people who maybe, you know, correctly didn't trust cryptocurrencies, mm-hmm. but thought, oh, well, this guy is a good guy, so he can't be a thief. But there was a huge push by VC money to make this respectable. So, you know, FTX would be the legitimate path through which you could bring money in and out of the crypto world, and his face was on billboards and so on. It all collapsed because he was using the customers' money to prop up really, really bad trades. Now, crypto was collapsing before, long before FTX, so it had been collapsing pretty much all year because a lot of the instruments that had been devised were completely ludicrous. So the idea of stable coins, which don't alter in value, turned out not to be very stable at all. Some were algorithmic stable coins, which they thought through some magical property would retain their stability. That wasn't the case. I mean, you more or less have to match it with a real asset. So the thing collapsed, and that had a cascade effect. And his great rival put the knife in, and it collapsed very quickly. Owing about, I think, $8 billion to, well, that's what the lawsuit says. There was no accounting. They sort of used WhatsApp to reconcile expenses and so on. I mean, the whole thing was a shambles.
It seems like a cautionary tale about the kind of cuddly capitalist situation. But I suppose my question as well is, what does this tell us about cryptocurrency in general? I mean, as you say, it was kind of in a pretty parlous state even before FTX kind of came crashing down. But where is that at this point, would you say?
Yeah, there's kind of a couple of worlds. I mean, there are different parts of the picture, and I've tried to be as kind of as objective as I can, because I think it's the easiest thing in the world to say this is full of scams and so on. And of course it is. I mean, why would you trust your life savings to an avatar with laser eyes? I mean, it's my case on regulating it. It's like, there should be some element of personal responsibility here. I mean, to me, that would have warning bells clanging. Is that there's something here dodgy here? I mean, this is why I think there's a lot of the concern about FTX is quite legitimate, because this cuddly, effective altruist was sort of presenting a face, trust me, and everything's going to be all right, which concealed the sort of desperate speculative nature of it. But it's a complicated picture, because there's the crypto world, but then there's the completely decentralized called DeFi world, which, you know, I referred to LARPing earlier. But that is fascinating. I think that will always be with us, because it's impossible to stop. I think pyramid schemes will always be with us, and always have been. They're ancient, and it's going to be incredibly difficult to regulate and impossible to tax. And if you don't like it, ignore it. DeFi kind of continues to grow, and people involved, they kind of, I think, savvy people know the risk, and they're used to having money taken, but that the fact that you can get higher than the bank rate returns will always attract somebody to whatever it is. So cryptocurrencies kind of flew up as a speculative bubble, partly because VCs bought into the idea of replacing the web or supplementing the web with these kind of tools, which were completely inappropriate. That collapsed about 6 months before FTX. But as long as there's something attractive and too good to be true, people will be attracted to it. I think that's just human nature.
So it's not going anywhere. But Chris, I don't think we've ever actually talked about cryptocurrencies on the podcast, a huge oversight. So, what do you make of this story and the whole world of crypto in general?
I don't fully understand this story. And maybe that's as much Mr. Bankman-Fried's business model's fault as my own misunderstanding. I mean, these things are incredibly complicated a lot of the time. I mean, the basic cryptocurrencies are fairly simple, but then you get all the middlemen and stuff like that. It gets a bit difficult. Cryptocurrency in general, I think, is basically a scam, or at least it's a kind of Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme. You know, people want to lose their money on it, then that's fine. If people make money on it, good on them. You know, Dominic Frisby, friend of the show, is a big fan of crypto. A lot of libertarians are. You know, I understand the libertarian dream of getting the government out of money. Mm. And if these things were reasonably stable, then they could actually act in that way. But they're not really used as a currency, because nobody wants to accept it, because it might halve in value in the next hour. And no one wants to spend it, because it might double in value in the next hour. So it's not really a currency. It's just a completely speculation in something that has no inherent value whatsoever. And nobody understands, as far as I can tell, why it goes up and why it goes down. Like, Bitcoin's gone up about 50% in the last month, having fallen massively in the last year, 18 months. But no one really knows why. You know, no one really understands why these things suddenly dip or suddenly go up. And you get these laser eye idiots on Twitter going, well, basically these things go in patterns. If you look at it's this kind of cargo cult element to it, where you look at the past performance and go, well, it went up then it went down, and so it's due to go up again. But there's no reason why it would do. At some point, people might see through the whole thing, it'll never go up again. Or it might go up massively. I've really no idea. But the point is, nor has anyone else. So it is just a gamble. Whether it's a good gamble or not, I don't know. I mean, it has been for some people over the course of the last few years. It may be a long-term disastrous gamble now. You know, the bigger picture with the stock market is that I've done okay out of the stock market in the last couple of years, because I tend to invest in companies that actually sell things and make money, which is has not been that fashionable these days. But, you know, companies that are going to be around for a long time, have been around for a long time, and are selling something tangible like oil or alcohol or, you know, even insurance or something, tend to be pretty reliable, and you just rest on the dividends. Whereas the companies have nosedived and people have lost a lot of money. I mean, crypto levels amounts of money are things like Tesla, a lot of the big tech companies, Netflix, Zoom, you know, companies that, all right, Apple make money, but a lot of them, it's all projections of what they're going to make in the future. Netflix kind of loses a huge amount of money. I think Amazon even still loses money. I'm not sure. Andrew will probably know better than me. But anyway, my point is, these kind of big tech companies, where it's all about how much money they're going to make in the future, are negatively affected by the current situation, partly because inflation's high, you know, and so those future profits are actually worth less than they would have been, as it were. Whereas people selling booze and fags, which is the kind of thing I tend to invest in, have been pretty much recession-proof and fairly solid. So, you know, good luck to anyone who wants to gamble on crypto, but it is a complete gamble. There's absolutely nothing in it. And as we've seen with this story, there are some pretty shifty characters doing things that a lot of people don't really understand. And it's interesting that he did manage to cover it up with all this kind of greenwashing and do-goodery.
And the kind of ease with which he managed to play on the fact that it seems like a lot of the people investing, or a lot of the kind of big business, big media backing that he received, didn't really understand this world whatsoever. And they were very kind of easily won over by the image he was trying to present. I mean, there was one, I think it was Sequoia Capital, had a blog on their website talking about how, you know, cute they thought it was effectively that he was video gaming whilst they were having some sort of Zoom meeting, and that they eventually, you know, ended up actually, you know, plowing a fair bit of money into FTX. What do you think this, the story of FTX, Andrew, sort of tells us about how credulous or slightly unwise a lot of these big financial institutions and so on are when it comes to these shiny, new, progressive-looking figures and companies?
Well, the financial institutions hate them, but VCs are desperate and they love them. That was an amazing interview. So, I mean, underlying everything, you've just got this era of cheap interest, of low interest rates. I mean, it hasn't really got a phrase. The one I've heard of, have you heard, guys, the everything bubble. So the last few years have been this everything bubble. Everything has become a bubble. But yeah, Bankman-Fried, I've met characters like him in real life. There was a character in Minder called Confident Clive, who could talk his way out of any situation. And Sam Bankman-Fried seems like one of these characters who thought he could talk his way out of an $8 billion hole in his balance sheet. As soon as the thing collapsed, he's giving interviews, and now he thinks he's flown back because he thinks he can talk his way out of fraud charges as well. So VCs loved him because they've tried so many things to bring the good times back of big returns. People trust them with colossal amounts of money, and they trust them for that reason, because they can get a higher return than if they put it in a more conventional, less risky asset. But they've really been kind of making promises they can't keep in the investment community, and it just led to WeWork, and I would put fake meat in that category as well, of utter desperation, of things nobody actually wants, but they keep receiving capital.
I want to move on to another thing that you've written extensively about, Andrew, which is also one of these industries, one of these products, which despite all of the money and will in the world doesn't quite get off the ground and doesn't quite overcome its problems. That is electric cars, electric vehicles. It's really become a kind of centerpiece, particularly for this country, but across the world, in terms of the pursuit of net zero. The UK government wants to, you know, effectively ban new petrol and diesel sales by, what, 2030 or something. And yet, at the same time, the take-up is never quite there. The issues with expense are never quite overcome for many people. Where are we going to get the power to power all of these electric vehicles and so on? You've been one of the people who've been most effective, I think, at kind of bursting the bubble around this issue, just sort of revealing the problems with it. So could you, again, just sort of give us a bit of an outline of why electric vehicles are not going to be the solution, at least in the near term, why they are kind of we're on a bit of a hiding to nothing with them, it seems like.
Yeah, I think the bubble has burst recently because this deadline has been set in stone of 2030. Now, car companies don't make cars. Actually, they kind of make car, these things they call car platforms. So, and they have to plan them years and years in advance. So they're now having to make investment decisions on whether the deadline for banning new ICE cars, and it'll obviously be, if it goes ahead on 2030, there'll be a huge spurt, will go ahead. And they're kind of having to plan what kind of car drivetrain will be inside the things they're selling for the next few years, for the next 10 years. But I think the overall picture is there's a huge rush by the bureaucratic establishment and the political, and there's almost complete unanimity amongst the political class that we have to do as much as we can as quickly as possible. But all the technologies to replace hydrocarbons are inferior to them. They're, apart from nuclear, there just isn't a superior technology. So they're in a process of banning superior technologies in, to try and urge the market to, well, giving the market no choice, but you have to buy something that isn't as good. And electric cars, as people are finding out, and I think it came to a crunch this Christmas for a couple of reasons. A lot of people made trips and found out the charging network wasn't there, so they couldn't complete their journey just before Christmas. The Tesla network was not sufficient for people to drive to Carlisle or Glasgow from the south, or to drive to the west even. So that was one thing. But also, I mean, with the car companies, the Toyota chairman voiced aloud saying, we're just rushing towards this. We're rushing towards banning superior technologies to hydrocarbons without thinking of what the alternatives might be. But I think hydrogen is even worse, if anything. So electric cars currently on the market, they're much more expensive. They don't have the range. It's a complete non-starter for a commercial freight fleet. If you have a 14-hour turnaround instead of a 10-minute turnaround, you're simply not viable. But what I don't think we're seeing is the political pushback across against all these measures, because China and India have no interest in surrendering hydrocarbon economy. Germany still, and this astounds me with the British media, is they don't criticize Germany for powering itself. It's just under 40%. It was 40% for most of the time since the Second World War. They haven't really dipped much below 30 now. Germany consumes 13% more coal. So it's almost like we're having the UK has decided to have the stupidity Olympics, but nobody else wants to come particularly. Now, I don't think the Biden and the EU have got lots of measures. I mean, some are incredibly harmful that people don't realize, like carbon border measures, so you won't be able to import something from China. We're just not seeing the political pushback against this. Now, I think things like heat pumps won't survive a single by-election. But nobody seems to be in that position to organise it. Nobody wants to break for cover.
And Chris, what do you make of the whole electric vehicles situation? Why has this not dawned on people before that they might not be all they're cracked up to be?
I don't know. I guess because people like the sound of them. I kind of like the sound of them. I think we'll get there eventually, like with a lot of these things. You know, it's just that politicians tend to jump in before these renewable alternatives are really ready to go and are anywhere near efficient. I mean, wind farms now, the technology has come on so much for wind farms that the North Sea genuinely could be a massive source of power and income. And I think it's actually something we should welcome. There is nothing wrong with renewables. They're great in a lot of ways. And similarly, solar panels, you know, have come on massively since the government effectively gave me some free solar panels over 10 years ago. They shouldn't have been doing that 10 years ago. They weren't that good, but they come on. And I think, you know, we will get there with this stuff. But what people don't realize about electric vehicles is that they're going to require Britain to roughly treble the amount of electricity it produces. And we can't produce enough at the moment for our current needs. And the only way to get close to it is by having a massive investment in nuclear. Wind isn't going to do it. Solar certainly isn't going to do it. It has to be effectively nuclear power, and we are still dawdling on this. So whatever we do, we need to be investing big time in nuclear power. Everyone knows it's expensive. Everyone knows it takes ages to get set up, but we're not going to go back to burning coal, quite clearly. Gas is clearly unreliable. And not really the future if we're going to kind of hold our ground against Putin. Some of this is okay. The charging points and stuff is, you know, and Andrew's absolutely right about both the, you know, the lack of facilities for charging, which would be unbelievably expensive when you consider you need to have a charging point essentially outside everybody's house, right? The infrastructure required to do this is absolutely staggering. And the heat pump thing, again, unless the price comes down massively, which I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to discount the possibility in 10 years' time, the price might have come down massively. But no one's going to put up with paying £10,000-£20,000 for a heat pump, particularly given that they're not as user-friendly by any means as conventional boilers. So this stuff will, I think it will get there, but it's folly to be spending or promising vast sums of money to buy technology which in 10 years will be much better and much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. And imposing it on people, it'd be one thing if, you know, the government was just spraying money at these various different industries, but actually banning things, forcing people to purchase them by various different measures, making it very expensive to run a older but more reliable, cheaper vehicle. I mean, you do just wonder at what point politicians thought, and it seems to be largely the green issue, but not exclusively the green issue, that it's completely fine to say, we're going to make your lives more expensive and more difficult, and that's going to be a good thing. You're going to like that. You're going to re-elect us. You're going to love us. It's going to be wonderful. At what point did that come in? I've no idea.
I think you found a fatal flaw with so many of these green issues. They don't improve. They make people poorer and they make people unhappier and they make people more miserable. The world is much more grey. And I mean, I think the rest of the world is by and large going to ignore climate change. It will say 0.1 degree of a centigrade a decade. That's fine. Can I keep my car? Yes, that's great. Well, what a great deal. We're just going to ignore it. I would disagree with Chris about renewables and gas. I mean, look, every country in the world has some gifts, and ours isn't the weather particularly or nice beaches, but we sit on hundreds of years of gas. So I don't see that. I think it's such a useful, methane is such a useful fuel. I don't see that going. And I don't see any improvements kind of technologically from solar and wind. It hasn't got windier. In fact, it's got less windy. And there is some really interesting research how wind speeds have dropped. Chris is right about the North Sea, but onshore we've had almost 5 or 6 weeks now out of 2 months where hardly any blades are turning onshore. I know there's a big lobbying campaign by the renewables industry to get more onshore wind turbines, but they are, that's literally like pouring money down a drain. I'd be happy seeing people digging a hole and filling it in and seeing more wind turbines onshore, which don't turn when it's coldest. I've done a lot on nuclear, and you know, it is one of the things we're really great at. Chris is absolutely right. For baseload, there's nothing like it. But what people don't realise is, and the French proved this empirically, is that it's easier to build lots at once than it is to build one at a time. If you build one at a time, it's painful and the supply chain is expensive. So you get scale advantages. And the French built, I didn't bring the numbers with me today, but the French literally built dozens. I think they completed 50 in 5 years. But once you've got a supply chain to build nuclear, you may as well build 20 to build one. And you can more or less put them in the same place that the original actor was. Looking forward 10 to 20 years, we could have a substantial electric base load, at which point maybe you can start to talk about electric cars again, but we can't until then. I mean, the government's figure for electrifying Britain so it could support heat pumps and electric vehicles was 4 times the generating capacity we've got. We're losing capacity. There'll be 2 working reactors in a couple of years. Lots of pigeons coming home to roost from decades of poor decisions and kicking the can down the road.
Definitely. Chris, I feel like this is a good point to turn to some of the nanny state stories of the month. I know there's a couple that we picked out, but I'd like to start with to check in with our old friend Devi Shridhar, who has sort of, you know, moved away from the zero COVID thing now that things aren't going so well in China, and is rediscovering her kind of first love, which was alcohol control, it seems like. This, of course, is the public health advisor in Scotland, became very famous during the COVID period for advocating, again, zero COVID policies in Scotland, but in general, but obviously has this sort of hinterland in all the usual nanny state blob, it seems like. Chris, I know you've been looking at what she's been up to, and also just how the kind of state of alcohol control in Scotland is going at the moment. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you found out?
Yeah, by all means. Yeah, lots of stuff coming out of Scotland at the moment on alcohol. So I think regular listeners will be aware that minimum pricing has not gone particularly well in Scotland. Devi, who, as you say, used to be zero COVID and is now... There's a sort of allegation often made that she just says whatever the SNP once said, and the SNP very keen on various alcohol control policies, especially minimum pricing, which they think puts Scotland on the map. So she wrote this thing for the Guardian saying that there was a big fall in alcohol-related deaths in Scotland between 2003 and 2012, which was true. there was a big fall, and no one really knows why. She thinks she knows why. She attributed it to four policies that Scotland supposedly introduced, and says that basically that England and the rest of the world should copy them. They are, just to run through them quickly, a ban on multi-buy discounts, like 2-for-1 or 3-for-2 or whatever. Well, that didn't actually come in until October 2011, which is a bit late in the day. And it has been evaluated by public health researchers, and they said it had no effect on alcohol consumption. Minimum pricing is the second one. Well, you know, it's failed to an almost hilarious degree, minimum pricing. You know, heavy drinkers consuming more, alcohol-related deaths at the 12-year high, no change in hospitalizations, people cutting down on food to buy alcohol and so on. Absolutely no evidence of health benefits. Then, and also it came in 2018, which is way after this period when alcohol-related deaths fell. Since then, by the way, they've kind of gradually gone up, if anything. Third one is reducing the drink drive limit. That came in 2014. So again, after the period she's talking about, and it's been reviewed by two studies, both of which found it had absolutely no effect on alcohol consumption or road traffic accidents, although it did somewhat harm the pub trade. And the fourth one is some kind of restrictions on alcohol marketing on television, which just doesn't exist. There is no such thing. The SNP have been lobbying for this, but they can't even do anything about it. It's a Westminster issue. So her fourth example of a policy that Scotland introduced and England should, it has never been implemented or even particularly seriously considered. So we have four policies there. One of them doesn't exist. Two of them happened after the period in question, and all three of them failed. And on minimum pricing, there was more news as well last week. It is being fairly well evaluated by Public Health Scotland, and that's how we know that it hasn't worked, really. It wouldn't surprise me if they suddenly pull a study out of the bag in the next few months, because the sunset clause kicks in April. There's a 5-year sunset clause. The government has to prove it's worked. Otherwise, supposedly it goes. But I think we all know in politics that's not going to happen. They will come up with some jiggery pokery to show that it's worked. But one of the interesting bits of the evaluation that was kind of quietly released was about people going over the Scottish border to England to buy cheap booze. And people in public health said, well, this will never happen. And, you know, for the vast majority of people in Scotland, it is a bit of a trek, right? You'd have to buy a lot of booze to make it worth your while. But this part of the evaluation, it found that 5% of Scots had gone over the border specifically and solely to buy alcohol. And about a fifth of Scots have brought alcohol back from England to drink in Scotland just to save money. Now, 5% is actually quite a lot of people making that journey. And it did occur to me that if I was in Scotland, I might just claim to have done that just to, you know, add to the figures to make it look like there's been unintended consequences. And there's always a kind of lizardman constant around about 5% anyway, people who misunderstand the question or who are mad or what have you. But the same report found that of the people who live within an hour's drive of the English border, 22% of them had gone to England specifically and solely to buy alcohol. So that makes me think, actually, this is a reasonably credible estimate, because naturally you would expect the people who are closer to the borders to be more likely to do that. And as I say, you would have to bring, even if you're only half an hour away, you'd have to bring back a fairly large amount of booze to make it worth your while. So I suspect that there's a fair old bit of, you know, cross-border action going on the Scottish borders, which also slightly compromises the claim that there's been a little fall in alcohol consumption or alcohol sales in Scotland, and indeed a rise in England. Presumably those figures are a little bit shaky, because some of the English sales will be to Scottish people, and some of the Scottish sales will be undercounted. So that's interesting. And it's also, hopefully, one day we'll get an evaluation from Wales, because, of course, people in Wales can very easily get over the English border. I mean, literally walk it in some cases. And, you know, I'd love to know how the Asdas and Tescos are getting on the Welsh border.
I love that idea of public health officials thinking, a booze cruise, that would never happen. Who would ever do something like that?
Right, yeah. We're just not the kind of people, are we?
I think we just obviously need a much harder border between England and Scotland than we envisage, more like, you know, Hadrian had with border posts and checks.
Maybe that's what Nicola wants. Yeah. But this is working out very well for our, you know, our off licences on the or near the border. There's apparently big Tescos on the last few junctions on the M6 going up to Scotland with very large alcohol sections.
Right.
I have been told. I haven't been up that way for quite a while.
There's the market working beautifully there, yeah.
So the SNP are doing their bit for levelling up in England?
And Chris, we should also talk about some developments on the data being in for the sugar tax as well, because, I mean, this is something which is often, again, sort of hailed as, I think I saw Wes Treat on television the other day from the Labour Party saying, I disagree with the Tories on a lot, but the sugar tax was fantastic. But as I understand it, some more evidence has been produced to suggest that maybe it wasn't as fantastic as its designers would hope that it would be.
Well, there's a study. A study came out saying it actually had worked. Mm-hmm. Again, it's been nearly 5 years since that came in. And a team of quite open advocates of the sugar tax were given £1.5 million to evaluate it. So, yeah, what are they going to say? You know, this includes, by the way, the great Mike Rayner of Oxford University, who's also a, I never fail to mention this because it's an incredible story. He's also a reverend in the Church of England. And he was on the record years before the sugar tax came in saying that he had literally heard the voice of God telling him to bring about a sugar tax in England. Right. This guy then did the modelling for the sugar tax, which showed that it worked, and he then got commissioned to do the evaluation of the sugar tax. Now, I don't know what the rules are in academia for these things, but that sounds like a conflict of interest to me. I mean, that's a much stronger conflict of interest than being funded by Coke or something like that. If even God has told you to bring about a sugar tax, you're unlikely to say that the sugar tax was a bad idea or didn't work. So anyhow, this is what things are like, yeah. And yeah, the rest of the academics evaluating it have a at least quasi religious belief in this policy. So they had to scrape around and find some evidence that it's worked. And child obesity actually went up the year after the sugar tax came in. It went up the year after that. It went up massively the year after that during lockdown, and it's currently almost to an all-time high, right? Notwithstanding the fact that child obesity doesn't actually measure child obesity. Let's put that to one side. It measures BMI to some extent, right? So we do know that on average, kids have got heavier over that period. And so they did a shocking piece of junk science, really, in which they created a counterfactual in which they estimated how much obesity would have risen amongst these kids had there not been a sugar tax, okay? So straight away, this is an art rather than science. And even doing that, they couldn't actually find any change amongst reception age kids. So that's 4 and 5 year olds of either gender. They couldn't find any change or effect amongst year 6 boys. That's 10, 11 year olds. But they did reckon they found a small effect amongst year 6 girls. And so that then became the headline. You know, there's been 6,000 fewer cases of childhood obesity since the sugar tax came in, which is actually a tiny number anyway. And so that then became the story. And I guess that's what they're going to use to claim that it worked. But it's quite obviously very fishy and very hard to explain why this wonderful policy would have an effect on a specific subset of girls, not boys of any kind and not younger children. They do come up with some post hoc bollocks in the study trying to rationalize this, say, well, we think actually boys are more influenced by advertising, and maybe the soft drink industry did more advertising around the time of the sugar tax than boys, which, I mean, completely speculative, absolutely no evidence for any of this stuff whatsoever, but needs must, you know. So they managed to scrape together a bit of evidence claiming to show it worked, and I have a strong suspicion that the minimum pricing people will do the same before spring.
I mean, it's always a good reminder that when people say evidence shows X, Y, Z, this is often the sort of evidence they're talking about. This kind of stick a finger in the air, make stuff up, draw out a tiny statistic. Yeah.
Well, we had a phrase for it years ago, didn't we? It was policy-based evidence-making.
Indeed.
Chris mentioned, we probably don't have time for this, but I'm really fascinated by the Mike Rayner story. It's quite amazing, isn't it, that he had a religious impulse. But I think Chris, he brought this out really early on, which was the puritanical dimension of, and one of the anti-alcohol campaign groups today can trace its roots back right back to the temperance movement of the Victorian times.
Yeah, the Institute for Alcohol Studies.
Yeah, so it's all about kind of reforming society, finding out what people are doing and stopping it, or finding out, I think more accurately, what people are actually enjoying and stopping them enjoying it. Because that great quote is, which is misattributed to Samuel Johnson, which is, people want to stop the bear baiting, not because the bear is suffering, but because people are enjoying the spectacle.
And do you see a big crossover with that, Chris? Is there a lot of organisations which basically date back to just being genuine Puritans of one form or another? Is there a lineage there?
Only really with booze. I mean, there definitely is that with booze. You've got an organization now worldwide called Mavendi, which is a very, very bland name, isn't it? A very corporate kind of name. But until very recently, they were called the International Order of Good Templars.
Doesn't sound dodgy at all.
Which sounds a bit more kind of weird and religious and almost like something from a Dan Brown novel. And so, yeah, they directly trace their lineage back to the mid-19th century temperance movement in Scandinavia. If you ever walk down Caxton Street in London, as I actually did the other day to try and find this office, you will find Alliance House. And Alliance House is now run and owned by the Alliance House Foundation, which sounds, again, pretty bland. It's called Alliance House because that building was bought by the United Kingdom Alliance for the Suppression of the Traffic in Intoxicating Beverages. It's a bit of a mouthful, but I think it gives you an idea of what they were after. They were prohibitionists, literally prohibitionists, formed in around about 1850. They bought that building. Prohibition obviously fell apart in USA and worldwide. They toned down their rhetoric and just started pushing for temperance. They created the UK Temperance Alliance, I think it was called. And that then got closed down in 1987 and was replaced by the Institute of Alcohol Studies, which sounds very neutral and, you know, just an academic kind of research body. But you'll be not surprised to hear they have never produced any research that is, shows alcohol in any way in a positive light. And I finally found their building the other day. They make a lot of money basically from renting this building out, and they give it all to the Institute for Alcohol Studies. And not only is the Alliance House Foundation based in that building, as I found out, but the Institute of Alcohol Studies is literally in the same office, or certainly on the same floor of quite a small building. So, I mean, they are absolutely joined at the hip. And if you look at the Alliance House Foundation's website, they make it very clear that they want people not to drink. It's, you know, it's a charity, and their charitable objective is to encourage total abstinence from alcohol. You know, so yeah, in alcohol, you do still get this this legacy of gospel temperance, not so much in the other areas, partly because there's never really been much of a grassroots anti-smoking or anti-obesity movement.
You didn't have the kind of anti-cake nutcases of 100 years ago. Shall we move on to some postbag questions?
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
I want to try and squeeze in one audience question, which I think ties together a couple of the things we've been talking about today, as well as some new stuff. This is from Quentin Vole. I wonder if that's his real name, but I'm with Popper on why proportional representation is a bad electoral system, but how/for whom can I vote for if I don't want HS2, net zero, or trans propaganda for eight-year-olds? Reform/SDP are still a wasted vote. Andrew, you got any views on how people can push back against all of these things, which feel like they've just been decided at a kind of elite level and then ladled out to us? You know, often people do feel quite disempowered.
Yeah, I think as people point out, all the parties are at one on this, and they're all outbidding they're in a race to outbid each other for how many things they can ban and how quickly they can bring in climate-related bans. And for the bureaucracy, but I think the problem is the bureaucracy and the blob almost kind of entirely does what it wants anyway. And the political side of this, it just says yes, or maybe the best it can do is kick the can down the road for a little bit. But I think the question is really pertinent, because a lot of these are so harmful to people. Even the ULEZ ban on movement is really crippling for care workers, for nurses, for anyone with a small business where they need a van. Without the political pushback, it's really difficult to see anything stopping. But a lot of this is so vulnerable, so poor. The policies are so harmful to people, and demonstrably harmful to people, such as high energy prices. But it's hard to see where that's coming from if everybody agrees with each other. I kind of agree, reform is a wasted vote. So it takes somebody from one of the main two parties, I guess, to break cover or simply convince the establishment not to do something. Like I said earlier, I think heat pumps can't survive a by-election. I think they're so awful. But when do people actually focus all that political organisation on one issue so it becomes that moment?
What do you think, Chris? Do you think the pushback is going to come in one form or another? Or are we going to kind of keep going down this road inevitably for a while yet to come?
I think we're going to keep going down this road inevitably for a long time to come.
That's a nice heartwarming point.
The only way you can approach this with a bit of hope is to say that support for this stuff is actually pretty shallow, even amongst the political class.
Yeah.
If you're talking about net zero, you know, the negative consequences in terms of costing people vast sums of money, you know, are becoming obvious and will become more obvious. And you know, if you look at what politicians actually do, we've been talking about electric cars and so on, and getting everybody out of their petrol and diesel cars. What has the government actually done in terms of taxing people out of their vehicles? Nothing. They've frozen fuel duty time and time again for the best part of 20 years, ever since those fuel protests way back under Tony Blair. So actually, fuel now, notwithstanding the fact that the oil prices went up, but yeah, petrol's coming down now. I'm pretty sure petrol, even now, is in real terms cheaper than it was 10 years ago, because politicians know that it's actually really unpopular to tax petrol and diesel. So judge people by their deeds rather than their words. On the nanny state stuff and the culture war stuff, wokery and all this kind of thing, you know, politics is downstream of culture. You know, if the culture changes and politicians will respond, you know, politicians just oafs really who pick up on what's going on in the culture a bit too late and then take it too far. So, you know, at the IEA, we believe in changing the climate of opinion over a long period of time. You know, we don't get involved in lobbying on specific things, partly because I think it's probably a waste of time. You need to change people's minds and win the argument.
And I think if, you know, Nicola Sturgeon can give up on a deeply held principle that any rapist should go in any prison he or she wants, then there's hope.
Well, that's a good example of something falling apart, you know, under just a bit of scrutiny and people, you know, paying attention to the issue, which I don't think they really did before. And yeah, those interviews with Nicola Sturgeon were hilarious, weren't they? It just shows that this ideology is very difficult to defend as soon as you get a kind of hard case.
Definitely. And it definitely feels like cars, heat pumps, etc. is going to really bring these things to boil in a way that a more expensive Mars bar might not, I dare say.
Well, if only heat pumps did bring things to boil, that's the
problem. I think part of the problem is how homogenous the kind of the political media and bureaucratic classes are. They were much more diverse. They had more working class people there. It was much more common sense. And the penny has to drop for somebody that there will be civil disobedience, there will be riots, the heat pump riots, the hydrogen riots, if they continue down this road that the rest of the world is ignoring.
But we will look forward to the heat pump riots, which is a fantastic coinage. We can only hope it takes place. Andrew, Chris, thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's great fun.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.